Then it will come to order. Messages from the House.
February the 25th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 417, Joint Conference Committee report adopted. Mr. President, Senate File 1, General Government Appropriations. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 50, noes 8, excused 2. February the 25th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 419, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 37, Health Insurance Definitions, ayes 54, noes 4, excused 2. Senate File 121, Performance-Based Evaluation and Design, ayes 55, noes 3, excused 2. Senate File 143, Federal Natural Resource Policy, ayes 54, noes 4, excused 2. And Senate File 47, Concealed Weapons, ayes 49, noes 9, excused 2. February the 25th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 429, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bills listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 49, Primary Care Support Program, ayes 59, noes 9, excused 2. House Bill 129, Nuclear Energy Production Study, ayes 58, noes 2, excused 2. House Bill 249, Acceptance of Citation, ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. House Bill 235, Natural Gas Vehicles, ayes 48, noes 10, excused 2. Concurrence, February the 25th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 418, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 29, Developmental Disability Services. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 56, noes 1, excused 2, conflict 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Message number 420, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 50, Medicaid Option. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. Message number 421, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 93, Dietetics Licensure. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 49, noes 9, excused 2. Message number 422, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 102, Medicaid Cost Study. Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 49, noes 9, excused 2. Message number 425, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 25, Long-Term Services and Support. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 51, noes 7, excused 2. Message number 427, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 70, Education Accountability. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. Message number 428, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file 107, Energy Impacted County Roads Program. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 53, noes 5, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
I have one assignment of a joint conference committee in regard to Senate File 85, Game and Fish Violations. That committee is composed of Senator Burns, Senator Landon, Senator Bebow. Mr. Majority Floor, Senator Bebow.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, may I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members of the Senate, one of the things that we do as a courtesy to fellow senators, if we in fact have an amendment to their bill or a committee bill, is that we in fact let them know. And I think, you know, we're really busy. It's getting toward the end of the session, and I just would encourage all of us to please do that. It's just a thing we've always done, and it certainly alerts them to it, and I think it's the right thing to do. So, Mr. President, just to bring that up and let everybody be aware of it.
Thank you, Senator Bebout, and I would concur. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're ready to go back on bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senator, that motion has carried. Senator Christensen, would you come back to the chair, please?
Yeah.
The Committee of the Whole, please come to order. We'll resume the reading. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 147. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 147, Excise Tax Vendor Compensation, an act relating to taxation and revenue, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanitzer. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, and Perkins. No, Senators Case and Hines. Senator Hines, Chairman.
You've heard the bill. Senator Hines.
Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 147. There is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that it be read in at this time.
House Bill 147, standing committee amendment number 1 to engross copy, page 5, line 1.
Mr. Chairman, I move the standing committee amendment, and what this amendment will do is change the effective date from July 1st, 2011 to January 1st, 2012. And the Department of Revenue said there was virtually no way that they could get this set up and ready to operate by the 1st of July. So they asked that we delay that 6 months. So that's what this amendment would do, and I call for the question on the amendment.
Senator Hines, are you ready for this? All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion to adopt the standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 147, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Standing committee amendment number 1 passes. The motion to adopt is passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, then I yield to Senator Peterson to explain the bill.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fellow senators and Mr. Chairman, I bring you House Bill 147. It's an old friend to some of the old-timers on this floor and in these halls. It's a new friend to some others of us that have heard it now for the first time, but it's becoming a good friend to some of us that like this bill. And basically what this is an excise tax vendor compensation bill. It has come up before. In fact, I've heard rumors that the last person that sponsored this bill now serves us in the U.S. Senate. So I have some big shoes to fill here, Mr. Chairman, and I hope I don't blow it. This is a good bill in the fact that it's a fairness bill. In this body, Mr. Chairman, we give exemptions all the time to new businesses moving into Wyoming, different industries, and this particular bill is looking at what I refer to as the worker bees of our state, our own in-state businesses that collect our sales tax and use taxes, and then, of course, return those taxes to the state of Wyoming. And they do it for free. But they take in all the liabilities and other costs of collecting that tax. And that's not so bad. In the old days, Mr. Chairman, it wasn't a bad thing. Sales tax, I understand, Mr. Chairman, is one of the three legs of our three-legged economic stool in Wyoming. And it's an important leg of that stool. Sales and use tax brings in almost $1 billion a year in tax revenue to the state of Wyoming. It's a large amount. The fiscal note on this is $7.5 million. And the whole purpose of this is basically to give back a credit to those businesses around our state, in-state businesses, that do this the favor of collecting this tax for us. If everyone takes advantage of this credit, which means remitting the sales tax before the 15th of the month, that's the incentive, which is 2 weeks before the deadline, then, of course, they would qualify for this credit. Right now, there are 27,000 vendors registered with the Department of Revenue, and of those, 213 remit over $6,250 each month. But this means that there's 25,000 small businesses who will be the major recipients of this credit. 25,000 small businesses in the state of Wyoming that, again, collect the tax and submit it to the state. Now, the state keeps 1% of that to cover the cost of administering the sales tax. I think it's somewhat hypocritical as a state to take that 1% and devote it to the Department of Revenue to collect this tax. They understand that there's a cost to collecting tax, just as there is a cost to the individual businesses out there collecting that tax. Yet there's no percentage of reimbursement to them to collect this tax. So that's an important point I'd bring out, Mr. Chairman. The small businesses are collecting the tax on behalf of the state and therefore assume the liability. If it's not done correctly, current businesses are subject to a late fee of 10% as well as a daily interest. You know, and when I was reading up on this, it reminded me of the musical Oliver, where the young boy, one of the foot soldiers of this orphanage, who they'd send out in the street and rob and get money in any way they could, come back to the orphanage. And you all remember the scene when he'd come up and ask for some more soup. And the guy behind the desk leaned over and said, "You want what?" And you know, these businesses out there are those foot soldiers for the state. And they're out there collecting these taxes. They submit those taxes. And they're doing a great job in doing that for us. And get nothing in return, really, as far as the tax that they collect. The bill, Mr. Chairman, on page 1, this is all it's doing is providing in the introduction, providing for a credit to vendors or direct payers for the collection and payment of sales and use taxes. On line 14, section 39-15107, this is in regards to the sales tax. You'll see the language that we are adding, laying out the plan of how this credit would be afforded and offered to these businesses. On line 3 on page 2, on or before the 15th day of each month of that month that the taxes are due under paragraph 5 of this subsection, a credit shall be allowed against the taxes imposed by this chapter for expenses incurred by a vendor or direct payer for the accounting and reporting of taxes. If the tax due is less than $6,250, the credit is equal to 1 95% of the amount of tax due. If the tax due is $6,250 or more, the credit is equal to 1%. So there's an adjustment there if it's over that amount, the $6,250. This shall each business, no matter the amount, shall be capped and will not exceed $1,000 in any month. The vendor or direct payer shall deduct the credit for each tax period on forms prescribed and furnished by the department. The credit shall be deducted only from the share of the tax that is distributed to the general fund. On page 3, it's the same language applying to section 39-16107. This is the section that refers to the use tax, but the language is exactly the same. That is the concept of the bill. It's come up before, Mr. Chairman. There's many arguments in favor of this, and I'm sure there's going to be many arguments that are opposed to the idea. It's $7.5 million less in revenue to the state of Wyoming, maximum. It won't be over that because we've capped it at $1,000. It's an incentive for the businesses to file and return those tax forms 2 weeks in advance. You have to do that to qualify for this credit. And so we look at it as some type of a incentive to increase compliance for these businesses. It would be my hope that more businesses be upfront and honest and get those tax returns back in an appropriate manner. You've gotten two handouts that I'd refer you to. One is gives you a reference of what other states have done in this regard. 28 other states have taken steps to give some type of recognition to these in-state businesses within their own states of the work they do in collecting of these taxes. And it'll give you the allowance or the basis of collection, the percentage, the maximum amount, and it'll give you the list of the states who have already passed such bills. The other handout, if I can find it, is just a talking points list. Some of the reasons of why this is such an important bill to our individual businesses around the state. It would provide more equity for Wyoming businesses, economic development, economic possibilities for future businesses, increased compliance, getting back to that 2 weeks ahead of time and to comply or to qualify for this. And something interesting has happened. You know, it wasn't such a big problem in past years, but as the Internet has come of age, out-of-state businesses, the market is somewhat complicated. And now we're surrounded by some states that charge no sales tax at all, but yet our in-state businesses are required to compete with those out-of-state businesses just across the state lines in some cases. And I know the argument is going to be, you know, the consumer is the one that pays the sales tax. But as a business owner myself, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that that's false. Because competition plays into this market. And when you're forced to compete against an out-of-state business that does not require a sales tax added to their selling price, the customer is very smart. And they'll make sure that the business is competitive. In fact, they'll bring in the newspaper ad of an out-of-state business and say, I want you to match this price. So the business says, okay, I'll match that price. $100. And then as they ring up the bill, of course we've got to add our 3 or 4 or 5% tax, sales tax on it. And the customer says, you didn't match the price. So the businessman is forced to either match the price and take that 3% out of that margin of profit. And I can tell you that happens every day in the business world. That sales tax is paid by the businesses, not by the consumer, because they sacrifice it in their margin of profits to compete with these out-of-state businesses, whether they be the box stores or the competitor out of state or now the Internet. And then we add to that problem that our businesses are incurring in the business world, we add a credit card. Now, the credit cards, anybody that's familiar with using credit cards and accepting credit cards in their business knows that there's a fee. That fee continues to increase. And you've got to offer the credit card option of purchasing to compete with the out-of-state businesses and the Internet. You've got to make it as easy as possible to purchase that product from your business. And so you offer the credit card. Well, here's the catch of the credit card. The fee from credit card companies can run from 2 to 5%, while retailers are being forced to pay sales tax on this amount as well, which is money that they never collect because it goes to the credit card companies. The Wyoming Department of Revenue collects the local sales tax from retailers and remits it to the local taxing jurisdictions in the state. For this, the Department of Revenue is already compensated at a rate of 1%. Businesses should receive that too. So besides the fee of the credit card companies also being taxed, again, the businesses are hit twice from our own state. Now here's an interesting thing that I've discovered as I've researched this. We talked about the out-of-state businesses. And the subject of Nexus came up and how we tax those out-of-state businesses for the sales tax that we lose if somebody purchases off the Internet or from out-of-state vendors. And this is how we handle that. It's on a voluntary basis. A voluntary basis. I asked the question, how's that working for us? Well, it's not bad. We collect almost $1.9 million in voluntary sales tax and use tax from out-of-state businesses, vendors. Here's the catch. The story gets better, Mr. Chairman. And it's an eye-opener for me. Wyoming is currently paying out-of-state vendors to collect and remit use tax for the state. I didn't know that. We're paying out-of-state vendors to collect our tax force, but not in-state vendors. Wow. Why shouldn't we pay our own in-state vendors, our own constituents, to do the same thing? I don't know. It's a good question, Mr. Chairman. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions and would appreciate favorable consideration from this body. This is a bill long past due, fellow senators. It's long past due. It's time we pass it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know where I am on this bill yet, but I do have a question. On page 3, lines 7 through 10, and I believe it's repeated, the credit comes back out of the state share of the sales tax, as I read that, and so the cities and counties are spared from their 31%. Now, I was wondering what that philosophy is based on. If we're going to be giving up about $7 million, I would think that the cities and counties would want to share the wealth, so to speak.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman. Maybe a little discussion about actually what a vendor is. The question I'd have is in a scenario where, say, you own fast food franchises and you have three of them in a town. Is a vendor on each one of those franchise locations, or is it simply just the vendor as the one person? And the same thing if you're a big box store across the state and you have big boxes in several of the communities, is the vendor just a single vendor, or is it a vendor for each one of those locations? And I'm not sure whether you can answer that today, but maybe if we could get that answered later. And then has there been any, and I think this is a positive aspect of the bill, if normally we don't remit those taxes to the state by the end of the month, and here we're moving it up to the 15th, it looks like we get 15 more days of use and 15 more days of income potential off of those early remittances. And has there been any discussion as far as the added income that the state would derive from getting its money and the use of that money, essentially 15 days that they don't have it currently?
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the question on which one would be a vendor is pretty easy to answer. Whenever you pay your $60 to get a permit to collect the tax with the state, that will probably, so if you own several facilities and you want to put them all into one permit, or you want to put one in each one, it's that $60 fee you pay probably decides which how many vendors you are.
Senator Perkins, excuse me, Peterson.
I was confused, Mr. Chairman. That is correct. It's based on your tax ID number and reseller's number. And so it's the big box stores that have multiple outlets, they have probably one tax ID number of the state, and that's one reimbursement, $1,000. There are some organizations in our state that have franchises. Those franchises have their own tax ID numbers, those individual businesses or locations. And so, again, it's based on your tax ID number. And so that would be a multiple instance. But for the big box stores that have one number, it's one reimbursement or one credit.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. How many of the people are in our state that collect this, and what percentage of the money is under the $6,250 threshold? Did you have any discussions about that? And certainly when you cap it at 1,000, I think that's a good idea when you look at some of the major retail places that have come into our state and have these huge facilities. And what really happens is they take a lot of the business away from those smaller guys. And I just want to know if you've taken that in consideration and how many are above and below that. And are you really taking care of the smaller businesses?
Senator Von Flatiron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I put a handout on your desk and it has my name on it. It's a little spreadsheet I made up quickly this morning. I just wanted to show the impact of this bill. And it'll show you that you have to be about a $1.5 million a year business. That's left hand. That's your total yearly sales. The next is your monthly sales. You have to do $125,000 a month if you find that number in that second column to make the top $6,250 in remittance. That's not in gross sales. That's what you're going to send to the state that month to qualify for the 1.95% in this bill. So what the state will allow you to keep is $121.88 for $1.5 million a year business. And I would submit to you that the bottom of that, somewhere around the $300,000 to $400,000 to $500,000, is your average Main Street bakery, little clothing store, something of that idea. So they're going to get $14, $15, $19, $25 a month. To get that $1,000 cap, once you get above the remittance amount of $6,250, you end up with 1%. So the way this bill is written, if you were to submit $8,750 a month, you'd actually get less than somebody submitting to the state $6,250. You have to get all the way up to submitting a remittance per month of $12,500 before you exceed what somebody sent us, somebody that only remitted $6,250. Then you're getting $125. To hit the cap in this bill, you have to have a business that generates $24 million a year to hit that $1,000 cap. I would say the upper end of these numbers on the left column, yearly sales, are mostly out of state. I would say that's your big box stores, car dealers don't collect tax at the store. Grocery stores would be the next one, but they don't collect tax on food unless it's prepared. So, you know, as my chamber, who is throwing darts at me right now, my chamber has said this is a great small business incentive program. Well, I would suggest to you that group's going to get $20 and $30 a month. It's not a lot. And somebody in the audit department, which we'll see later, has to audit these claims to see if they are rightfully taking the correct amount and following up if they're not. So that's quite a little expense, I believe. And this is costing $7.5 million a year to the state, just the state, by the way. And if you look at Goldenrod, I think you see what we're going to possibly put about $5 million away this year in savings. Well, I think you're just about $2.5 million in the hole on this year's budget. So it's a big hit for the state. Do we take it from the money we're giving the cities, towns, and counties? In-state stores, yes, we build sidewalks, roads, utilities to them. I don't like the fact that we're not part of the streamlined sales tax and we're paying somebody to collect some of that sales tax that we're not. We can't actually enforce from out-of-state vendors on the Internet. Wait till we join the streamlined sales tax, or I think when Congress finally puts it together and gets us all on board there. But for right now, this is not a lot of money to any individual business. Most of it will go to big businesses which are not located in the state, and it's a big hit for our budget.
Senator Hastert.
I'm sorry. No, I didn't.
Is headed out of the room. Senator Schiffer.
Come back, John. Mr. Chairman, I'll try and answer some of these concerns. Somebody mentioned that the share of this comes out of the state's share of the sales tax. I guess a couple observations. The local cities and counties, I'm not sure that when they see what a great idea this is, they will probably beg to be participants and contribute to this. We know that from the discussions on the tax on food, and if they really behave, we'll let them in. But I'm not sure right away. We're not going to roll over. But my point is this. To the state of Wyoming, I'm not sure that the $7.5 million is being touted as the cost to the state. And I would beg to differ with that. Part of the incentive built into this is that the people are get this when they pay 2 weeks early. On just a normal rollover, that means for an extra 14 days, the state picks up an additional $36 million to invest. We get the use of that money 2 weeks earlier because of the incentive built into here. You name whatever interest rate we're going to get. We've seen it go from 5% to as low as, 2% in some of those accounts, but it'll be invested wisely and at a very high rate. And then multiply that times the 12-month. This applies once every 12 months. It's not a net loss to the state. We get the money quicker. We get the money to invest sooner at a very high rate of return. The other thing, there's no doubt, if you look at what the remuneration is, say you qualify for the $121. It's not a lot. But at least it tells those Main Street businesses, we acknowledge your contribution to our economy. And let's remember, folks, that's what our Main Streets are built on. They're not built on the box stores. They're built on those small businesses. And this is it going to break the state? It's not even going to come close. Not even going to come close. We're a wealthy state. But consistently, we add expenses to our small businesses without even recognizing they're the ones, when if you've got kids in school and they're going to have a basketball tournament or a rodeo or whatever, those are the people that ante up. Those are the people that provide the services in the library and support your library and your youth group, and a lot of them will be your CASA volunteers all across the spectrum. That's who it is. 121 bucks, is it going to make them rich? Nope. It's just saying we appreciate what you do for our economy here in Wyoming and in Campbell County or wherever it is. So I urge you to support this bill. This is a good bill. I urge you to vote aye.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I wanted to point out, a question was brought up about, the good Senator from KC kind of addressed part of that, too, was, why we don't include the cities, towns, and counties, local governments, in this equation. Well, I can tell you one thing. They're already paying as it is. They pay 1%. Just for the privilege of the state collecting the money and passing it on to them. So, if you want to double dip the local governments, I guess you can do that by including in this. But we're already hacking them anyway. Besides that, they get 31% of the cut of the sales and use tax. The local governments, you take 1% of that off, they get 30%. The state keeps 70% of this money anyway. So it's not like you're really giving them an overwhelming amount of this money. So, if you want to go down that road, I guess, and say we'll double dip the counties and local governments, that's fine. But I don't think we really want to go there. It's a good bill. I think we ought to act on.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, just for a little bit of clarification, the state of Wyoming is not paying a vendor fee to out-of-state vendors. I just checked with the Department of Revenue, and the confusion may be that they pay some certified service providers, and these are what have been set up through the streamlined sales tax on the national, and they'll go to companies and contract with them to do all the bookwork to collect the tax and to remit it to Wyoming. And then Wyoming pays them this fee. Last year, out of the $1.9 million we collected, Wyoming paid $15,847. And I might also add that I have worked with the streamlined sales tax since it started a little over 10 years ago, and Wyoming was the first state that passed the law that the national group set up. I know because I sponsored that bill. And we're struggling along. We have to have the U.S. Congress approval before we can make it mandatory. So at this point, we have quite a group of national companies that are doing it voluntarily. They're doing it in Wyoming and other states. Some of the big box companies apparently are doing it that have big mail order catalogs. And why I've always supported this streamlined sales tax is because I think it's a fairness issue for our local businesses. As previous speakers say, we always go to them for donations and things. And so they're competing against out-of-state companies that are getting a lot of business. If you think about this $1.9 million we collected in sales tax, that's nearly $40 million that we bought from out-of-state businesses that are collecting, and how many million more that are not cooperating with us at this point. So it's not that we're not supporting our local businesses when we don't support this means of compensation to the vendors. I think every group, and what I brought up in committee and mentioned that we have quite a few other groups that collect tax for the state. Most all of us do in one form or another pay taxes or collect. I pay a monthly tax to the federal government, and I get penalized pretty good if I don't get it in on time and on the right amount, and there's no vendor compensation for that. So, you know, our vendors don't pay. They are exempt for everything they buy that they resell. We have that in our current law that have been that way virtually forever. We're a low-tax state, and what we're doing with all of our programs, we're eating away on our income, and ever since I've been in the legislature, we've been working to diversify our economy so we don't depend on the mineral industry so much, and at this point, we're depending on the mineral industry more than we did when we started all these programs. So I think in the long run, we need to be considerate of what we're doing to our tax base and how we're spending it, because somewhere down the road, we're going to have to make some big adjustments, and the more of these programs we put in, the tougher it is for whoever here to make those adjustments in the future.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm grateful for that clarification. I didn't read my full note, and it does, when we pay outside vendors, it is that use tax. But this bill is sales and use tax. And that is based on a formula, that reimbursement. And at that time, I was trying to get this figure. It was that 1.9 is what we collected on that voluntary basis. And it was directed to each service provider, but it's done by a formula. And the formula, as close as we can figure, was somewhere between 4 and 8%. 4 and 8%. We're asking for 1% here. Probably a good time to address, Mr. Chairman, the Committee of the Whole amendment. I apologize for not addressing it earlier. I got so enthused and involved with this bill that I forgot to do my own amendment. And I would ask for that to be read at this time, Mr. Chairman.
House Bill 147, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 4.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 147 and ask for the body's favorable consideration. Mr. Chairman, this bill or this amendment came about as this bill was being presented on our side of the Capitol. And the department was asked the question how much it would cost to implement this program. And the department responded $160,000. And it was the first time I'd heard the presentation on the bill. And so being a good appropriations member and a good businessman myself, realizing that everything has a cost, I decided to bring a committee of the whole amendment to make sure that the department had the money necessary to implement this bill if passed. And so that's the explanation of the $160,000. Apologize for it not being taken care of on the other side of the Capitol, but once again, we're trying to clean up a mess here from the other side. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for the body's favorable consideration on Amendment Number 1, or Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Senator Burns.
On the amendment, I see that it appropriates $160,000 to the Department of Revenue for it, but and any part not used reverts, but then it said it shall not be included, so it's not part of an ongoing appropriation. I don't quite understand how I could see where it would cost a little more to start up the program with the Department of Revenue, but I'm kind of curious as to why that income stream wouldn't necessarily continue. If the program's going to continue, you're going to have somebody who's going to have to continually audit the vendors to make sure that money being held back is correct. So I don't understand why it's 160 one time.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to that and asking the department that same question, they said it's just basically the startup cost. Those audits and things are already happening right now, and the expense of running a program such as this isn't going to increase the cost of that department that much. And so the 160 was for computer programming, changing those things in their software to basically carry out this, the intent of this bill. The forms that would have to be sent out to the businesses that respond and the vendors, the forms have to be changed. So those are the startup costs that we're talking about, and that explains the $160,000.
The question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 147, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 147 is passed. Back on the bill.
Question.
Although, question having been called, excuse me, in the back, Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, with respect to the use tax and the vendors, I assume that the use tax then, or although they're not the boxes or the stores collecting it, it's the use taxes, I think, are paid for by the refineries, by the folks that are buying equipment. These are your manufacturers, people that are buying the equipment from out of state. So I assume that each one of these folks that are now paying taxes are going to get a credit for paying their taxes. Is that accurate?
Senator Peterson.
That would be correct, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly what we're talking about. Mr. Chairman and fellow senators, it's a fairness issue. I think we just need to treat our in-state businesses the same as we treat our out-of-state businesses. I you know, the good senator behind me refers to them as foreigners or foreigners. I refer to them as friendly pirates. And you've heard me speak on this floor about dollars leaving our state faster than we can enjoy the benefit of them. This is just a fairness issue. My colleague that sits in front of me here is absolutely right. It's not much as far as individual businesses are concerned. $50 a month, $38 a month, $20 a month, $4 a month. But it's just the thought of saying thank you. Appreciate you doing business in Wyoming. Thank you for collecting the tax, being honest, being upfront, getting it in on time. Keep up the good work. Keep collecting those taxes. That's what it's about.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, folks, I mean, you got to think about where this is going. Let's take the in that situation the coal mines, the cement plants, the refineries, all those folks. Now we're going to say to you, you get to keep part of your tax, and you don't have to pay for all the cost of the services, which are the sales tax, which goes to it. And you know, all of us have it. I've got a full-time employee who does nothing but pay taxes for the for unemployment, pay taxes for workers' compensation. We pay. Nobody gives you a credit for those. That's part of the cost of doing business. And in fact, for our property taxes, if you're in the business, we've got a staff person who spends a couple of weeks doing nothing more than going around and inventorying everything in the office, all the equipment out there, and all that goes together, and then I pay my property tax and my personal property tax on that. There is a cost of doing business for this transaction. So now let's take the use tax vendors. We're going to say to the use tax folks, all these folks that are essentially having employees doing exactly what my employees do, and say, now you get to deduct from your taxes part of the cost of doing business. And in that sense, that those are taxes they're expect to pay. So they're not being treated like us. If we're going to give everybody a tax break, then let's give everybody a tax break on paying your unemployment taxes, the cost of doing the paperwork, your workers' compensation, all those taxes. Now, when you get to the vendors out there, who's getting the biggest bang for the buck? Is it the down street or the business downtown? No, it's the big boxes. They're the ones that are getting the biggest bang for it. You see the tables out here that provide for it. But more than that, when you start getting to the issue with respect to the sales tax collected, those are our dollars. I raise four children. I'm probably one of the biggest consumers out there paying those dollars in our community, and I shop everything I can buy, I buy locally. And part of the reason is because that's where I pay my sales tax. And that 5 or 6% in our case, that sales tax is my intention, would go to the community and to the state. And it's what pays for the roads, it's what pays for, and incidentally, for all these folks downtown, we're paying for the lights on the street lights that go down there, we're paying for the roads, most of those were sales tax that paid for a lot of those improvements, at least in Laramie. We're paying for, when you wake up you go to bed at night and you see those lights down there, who's paying for that? The community. Where do they get the money? From sales tax. Who's getting most of the benefit? Those small boxes, those small residents down there. When you look at our budget and where's this going to come out of, and it won't stop here, folks. You can see these schedules. A lot of those other states, by the way, they have income taxes. They have other forms of taxes these same businesses are paying. But in this case, they started out wanting a $24 million per biennium tax break. Now they've shaved it down to about $15 million. Go look at your goldenrod. Where is it going to come out of? Well, I could tell you where it's going to come. It's not going to come out of the health programs because those are mandatory. They're going to be coming up, and we're going to be paying for them. It's going to come out of economic development, dollars to the business-ready communities, dollars to infrastructure for roads, dollars for all the things that you've seen go out there. You know, this is one of those things where, frankly, not one of my vendors, not one of my client, the vendors in my community come in and said, I need this. They're collecting our tax, and when you pay your tax, you're not paying your tax to the vendor. When I bought the purchase price, if I paid a dollar for this, I expected that the vendor puts his profit into the cost of that. And when somebody pays me my fee, he assumes that that's going to cover all the cost of doing business, which includes my staff, the cost of paying my taxes, the cost of paying my withholding. In a sense, this is like your 941 taxes, where you're taking your employees' money, their taxes, and you hold on to them, and then you send them off to the federal government. They don't belong to you. They belong to the guy that paid the tax. And in my instance, when I pay the five or six cents, it's my expectation that money goes to the state. and that the vendor collects and pays, collects his cost and the cost of doing business. He's still got to have a cash register. He's still got to send money in. All that's part of the cost of doing business. There's no extra cost in doing this. So all we're doing is saying, well, you give a credit. A credit against what? The credit against my money that I sent out to pay my taxes and to pay for the roads, to pay for the lights, and partly to pay for the police service and all the protection that provided to the stores downtown. And the money has to come from somewhere. And you look at your goldenrod, you can see where it comes. The first thing that will come off is highways. We wanted to put more for highways this year. We cut them back. We wanted to pay more for cities, towns, and counties. We cut it back. And I suppose it doesn't make much difference whether you charge some of the cities, towns, and counties anyway, because ultimately we just say, well, we don't have enough money to pay you this year. But mostly it's all about transparency. I think when you go and you pay your tax and the vendor puts it on a sheet that says this is your tax dollars, your expectation that's going to pay for the cost of doing business. And the government, all the police services, all the lights, all the roads that you had when you walked in there. Folks, this is a bad bill. It won't stop here. It'll only be, the next year we'll be asked to do more and more. And it has to be made up from somebody. And it's ultimately going to come out of your highways and roads. I urge you to vote no.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is a cost of doing business, but it also is a way to put a little bit of money, not a whole lot, back into those businesses that collect sales tax. So I'd ask you, kind of look across the state at all the different kinds of businesses. We've got the stores, the people that sell the widget to you. We've got people that do services, consultants. We've got a lot of consultants in the oil and gas industry. They don't pay sales tax. Professional services, doctors, dentists, and some other guys that have professional services don't pay sales tax. So I think the box that we're worried about opening here is not the box that we're going to look at sales tax and say, let's give these guys, the backbone of our society that collects these taxes, a little bit of a break. The box is, where are we going to go open and start looking at the businesses in the state that don't pay sales tax? That's the danger of what we're going to open, because if you give this $7 million back to the people and we're looking to replace it, we're going to go looking to the people who are not paying sales tax and figure out how to get them to pay sales tax to make up that $7
million. Majority Floor Leader, Mr. Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, it's my intent at this point in time to declare a conflict. You all know my family and the number of restaurants that we have, not only corporate, but franchises throughout the state. So bottom line, this bill, if it passes, puts money into my pocket. And therefore, I do declare a conflict in that regard. But I am also a member of a bigger class, a pretty big class, and so I reserve the opportunity to comment. And with that, I will tell you that when you look at the goldenrod and you look what we just did and what we had to cut, which we went away from one of the Senate positions that I felt strongly about, and that's that DD people and so forth. And I submit to you, somewhere along the line, we're going to have to make that money up. And the question is, who best deserves that? And I submit to you that we're just doing fine. I'm doing fine. Our companies are doing fine. And I always look to my wife as a guide to sometimes some of these tough decisions, because I even debated whether or not this bill should come up. But the fact of the matter is, it does deserve the discussion here today. But what she said was, what do you mean? That's part of doing business. That's part of being a good citizen in the state of Wyoming. We are thankful that our company is a Wyoming company. And when you look at the taxes that we have to pay, it's not much compared to other places in terms of, look at what our property taxes are. Look how low our sales taxes really are in comparison to Colorado or others. We don't have any corporate tax, and we have no income tax. And so when you start looking at our tax base and you decide if this is what we want to do, and it sounds laudable, but in the end, it seems to me that we have a responsibility to all the people in the state of Wyoming. And at some point in time, there's a big looming monster out here, and that's health care. And somehow we're going to have to be able to pay for that. We already know, I think, from the discussion this morning, that the next time we come around here, there's $230 million that we're going to be looking at in health care. And so while this may be, it's nice to say we would support small business, we all do. Quite frankly, we're all small businessmen in this Senate. I don't see some monster corporation representatives here. The fact of the matter is that, if we want to move forward as a state, you ought to take a hard look at what we're doing here today.
Senator Peterson.
I'll be brief. Good comments, good discussion, good debate. It's an important issue. I think it would make all the difference in the world to these smaller businesses. These are our good foot soldiers out there in our state. This is the diversity that we're looking for in our state. This is the backbone of it, small business. We're trying to diversify ourselves away from minerals, and so we're not so dependent on that. This is the area that we need to strengthen. And quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, I'd rather have the $7 million in their hands than in our hands. I come from the business world. I serve on appropriations. The only way that we can make cuts is don't give us the money. I'd appreciate your vote. Thank you.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 147, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
House Bill 147 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 161.
House Bill 161, Interstate Compact on Students of Military Families and Act Relating to Education, sponsored by Representative Illaway. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Jennings, Landon, Rothstuff, excuse, Senator Cole, Senator Kit Jennings, co-chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Jennings? Senator Johnson.
To report that it do so with a favorable vote on House Bill 161. Did I leave anything out? I was winging it. Okay, fellow senators, we have something here that we haven't had in the Capitol for a long time. We have an interstate compact. And I think I can remember the previous one. It was years ago. What are they? And interstate compacts are the most powerful, durable, and adaptive tools for ensuring cooperative action among the states. They provide a state-developed structure for collaborative and dynamic action while building consensus among the states. The U.S. Constitution says that compacts cannot be made between the states unless approved by Congress. So this interstate compact on educational opportunity for military children has been approved by Congress, and if I remember right, there are 35 states that have already passed it. Okay, what does it do? Mr. Chairman, the military families move between postings on a regular basis. While reassignments can often be a boon to their personal career, they usually play havoc with their children, and they're losing and making new friends, adjusting to new cities and bases, and changing schools. While the armed services has taken great leaps to ease the transition of personnel, their spouses, and most importantly, their children, much remains to be done at the state and local levels to ensure the children of military families are afforded the same opportunities for educational success as other children, and are not penalized or delayed in achieving their educational goals by inflexible administrative and bureaucratic practices. The average military student faces transition challenges more than twice during high school, and most military children move six to nine different schools in their lives from kindergarten through 12th grade. So what does House Bill 161 do? First of all, the transfer of records. Official transcripts for military-affiliated children often come from other states or overseas, and they're lost, or they take forever to make it. So the first thing is that the parents of the children can carry unofficial transcripts and unofficial records, and the school that they bring it to can accept them and use them till the official ones get there. They take care of course sequencing. States have varying prerequisite course requirements that can result in thwarting students' academic advancement. Repeating content or eliminating students from honors or advanced placement courses. Graduation requirements may vary from state to state. In some states, they have specific courses for graduate or senior year may be jeopardized and usually are if they are unable, due to state or local policies or scheduling constraints, to enroll in the necessary coursework. There's a lot of exclusion from extracurricular activities. A new student will come in, and they'll be told by the coach, we picked the team 2 weeks ago, and now you can't participate in this activity. And they're penalized because their parents are in the military. We have redundant or missed entrance exit testing. They move frequently. They can be penalized for missing mandated state classes. Kindergarten and first grade entrance ages vary. Children enrolled in kindergarten in one state may not qualify by age when transferring during the year to another state. And then one final one that is very interesting, the power of custodial parents while parents are deployed. Due to circumstances created by military deployment, there are times when the children are placed in care of designated guardians. The legislation is needed to protect the children of these families so that they may continue to attend their school or relocate to the neighborhood school of their newly appointed guardians. As I said, this is a good interstate compact. 35 states have it, and I think it's necessary that Wyoming also joins it. And I stand ready for questions, but there is also a committee of the whole amendment.
Reading clerk, if you'd read the amendment. House Bill 161, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 48, after line 5.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 161 and ask for your favorable consideration. Members of the Senate, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, that there was a couple of places in the bill where there were some issues over sovereign immunity and issues about the Governmental Claims Act for Wyoming, and the amendment simply states that that under any no conditions that do we waive our sovereignty for Wyoming or give up anything under the Governmental Claims Act. That's, in essence, all we're doing with the amendment.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry you caught me unaware, and thank you, Senator from Cheyenne, for covering for me. I think this amendment probably clears up a lot of the questions on would this give the ability for the federal government to override state local control. So I would consider it a friendly amendment and hope you support it.
Question on the amendment. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Hastert's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 161, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion to adopt the Standing Committee, or the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 161 is passed. Back to the bill. Question on being called. All those in favor of Senator Johnson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 161, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. House Bill 161 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 178. The reading clerk, please read it.
House Bill 178, Vault, Crypts, and Mausoleums Perpetual Trust Funds, an act relating to cemeteries and burials, sponsored by Representative Kraft. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, and Martin. No, Senator Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a very scary motion on it. House Bill 178, Vaults, Crypts, and Mausoleums, Perpetual Trust Funds. And for an explanation of the bill, I yield to the good senator from Sweetwater County.
Senator Hastert. Excuse me, Senator Martin. I was stuck on scary. Excuse me, Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 178, Vaults, Crypts, Mausoleums, and Perpetual Trust Funds. This short bill seeks to remedy old language that is problematic for small Wyoming churches. Our Wyoming statutes clearly regulate the construction and maintenance of columbariums, which are vaults specifically designed to hold the ashes of persons who have chosen to be cremated. As cremation has become an option for more and more Wyoming residents, many churches are choosing to install columbariums inside their buildings for use by the parishioners. Wyoming statutes specifically exempt churches from the regulations governing large, for-profit columbariums operated by cemeteries and funeral homes. Churches are exempt throughout the statute, except in one critical portion, the one stating that before anyone can construct a columbarium, they must deposit in an institution acceptable to the state insurance commissioner $10,000 for a perpetual trust fund. This requirement completely excludes virtually all smaller churches from installing a columbarium, and many of them reported they couldn't afford to tie up $100, much less $10,000. All this bill seeks to do is exempt churches from this trust requirement, just as they are currently exempt from all other requirements contained in this statute. Small columbariums need no maintenance. Their exterior covers are typically bronze. Interiors are sealed in aluminum. And while it may be prudent to require trust obligations for larger facilities, these columbariums typically contain around 24 inches or niches, and occasional swipe of the polishing cloth is usually the extent of necessary maintenance. In short, Mr. Chairman, this bill asks for the requirement of maintaining a large and unnecessary trust fund be eliminated for churches. They are exempt from all other portions of the statute. Why not this one? Allowing this requirement to remain in statute creates a huge inequity for smaller churches of limited resources who only wish to offer the same options to their congregation as those which larger, wealthier congregations enjoy. The bill is really about fairness and equity, Mr. Chairman, and would ask for your favorable consideration.
Discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 178, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 178 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 189. Please read the bill.
This corner is done good today.
House Bill 189, Foreclosure and Redemption Revisions, an act relating to real property, sponsored by Representative Stubson. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that with the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it is with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 189 for closure, redemption, revisions. For explanation of the bill, I ask that you would call upon the good the majority floor leader, Senator Ross.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 189, foreclosure and redemption provisions. This bill has basically four changes to the foreclosure laws. The first deals with rescission, which is in a new statute created, 118-115. And what this provides for is that any time after there's a foreclosure sale, but before there's been actually the deed, the sheriff's deed has been filed, it allows for a rescission potentially to occur between the mortgagee and the mortgagor, and allows more flexibility in terms of what we do in terms of foreclosure. There are times when the circumstances make it such that perhaps the lending institution or the borrower have come to terms and they'd like to rescind the foreclosure sale. There's no provision for that now, and that's what this does. So if you look at the changes on the first three pages, basically paragraph B on page 2 is when the mortgagee and the is the purchaser. So let's say the lender decides to bid in at the foreclosure sale. This allows the mortgagee to then rescind the deal with the mortgagor. Or if it's not the mortgagor or the mortgagee that buys the at foreclosure sale, but somebody else, it allows the mortgagee and the new purchaser, the certificate holder, to agree to some terms, perhaps that would make it more feasible, rather than simply the foreclosure price plus 10%. So, and there's notice. And that goes out and has to be filed. If the purchaser and in D on page 2, the purchaser and the mortgagee, if the purchaser doesn't agree, but there's still statutory requirements perhaps that have not been fulfilled within the foreclosure sale, then they can either agree to something different or shall refund to the certificate holder the purchase price plus 10% per annum. What happens if there is a rescission and everybody kind of goes back to square one? I mean, all the lien rights, the junior lien rights, all go back. They still have their standing. But it provides options to with regards to these foreclosure sales. The second provision deals with redemption. And that is in section 2, 118-104. The current statute only allows for a redemption when the borrower or a junior lien holder pays the amount paid at the foreclosure sale plus 10%. This bill would allow the purchaser and the redeeming party to agree on a different amount if so desired. So it's a matter of contract. So it clarifies some language there, and it provides more flexibility for the parties to reach agreements that fit the circumstances at that time, rather than a statute that dictates what everybody must do at a foreclosure sale. The next thing that it does is it clears up some ambiguity with regards to redemption of if the property is agricultural. And basically, right now, if it's not agricultural property, the redemption period is 90 days. But there isn't any outside limit on agricultural property. But there is a right under agricultural property to redeem for a 12-month period. So on page five, what it says basically is that the mortgagor can stay with the property, with the land, until the redemption period expires. So the 12 months. Then the last portion of this bill deals with the sale of multiple lots, when you have multiple lots. And while I don't practice a lot in this area, it's best if I just comment from the handout that the good House member, House sponsor gave me. Sale of multiple lots. The foreclosure process for properties that are made up of multiple lots is impractical in many respects. If there are multiple lots subject to a mortgage, the law requires you to sell each of the lots individually. If the mortgagor does not get the full amount of the mortgage, they are then required to sell them as one single piece of property. This requirement applies even if the sale of the parcel as a single property results in a lower bid. The bill allows the mortgagee to decide whether to sell the lots individually or as one parcel. The mortgagee, which is generally the lender, has the incentive to liquidate the collateral in a way that results in the highest bid. When you mortgage property, you provide all of it as collateral. This says that the foreclosing party can elect to sell, can elect whether to sell separate tracts or to sell them as a whole. It also permits the parties to structure a deal from the outset to determine when a given mortgage is secured by multiple lots, single lots, or a combination of the two. That's basically the bill. I would urge your favorable consideration.
Senator Bebelt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I understand the presentation, that whether you redeem it or not, and even after, if you agree to redeem it and then something should fall through, your priority of liens stay the same. The question I have is, what if there's an intervening lien in the meantime, and specifically an IRS lien, that they just come in and have a blanket lien for the entire county, and you probably don't even know about it. Now, are we jeopardizing the positions of liens with this kind of a bill if, in fact, the redemption should fall through, and then the blanket lien comes in by the IRS, and then you had a secured position, you were before the IRS, but because of this intervening thing with the redemption, they put a blanket lien on countywide, sometimes statewide, and there you are, and you've lost your position.
Senator Ross.
I don't believe that this bill changes anything with regards to your lien priority where you are. But the real fact of the matter is, I guess if that occurred now, the IRS always seems to be able to get their money first. That's just, a fact of life, but I may be wrong, and I'd yield to the chairman of Judiciary Committee.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just for a point of clarification, I think what this bill does is it simply revives those liens, and everything's exactly where it was prior to the sale when you have a rescission or when it comes back. Everybody just goes back right where they were. And so ultimately in those things, if it's a real estate lien, it's first in filing. You've got whoever has their lien filed at the appropriate time, they have the priority. With respect to personal property, bank accounts, or other things like that, it's you have your perfection on that typically when you reduce it to possession. There are some, there's an entire issue of law, but I don't think this affects that. I think everything just goes right back the way that it was prior to the sale. So I don't think that there's, those opportunities for the super priority lien, such as sales, real estate tax and things like that, always have that ability to angle in there. Bankruptcy has a certain way to strip liens, but I don't think this bill affects any of those things. I don't think that this changes your position as a creditor.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, during the fall, there was considerable publicity with some of the states having great difficulty in the foreclosure process due to some technical defects. I gather this bill does not get into that sort of thing. Am I right in thinking we did not have that problem here in Wyoming, or did we?
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I am unaware that we've had that problem. In fact, I think we've been one of the few states that haven't had that problem.
Discussion? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion, and when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 189, say aye.
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 Those opposed? House Bill 189 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 194.
House Bill 194, next of kin driver's license option, an act relating to driver's licenses, sponsored by Representative Pedersen. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transfers, Highway, and Military Affairs. PACS reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Johnson, Landon, Nutting, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I move in the committee of the whole rise to report to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 194, next of kin, driver's license option. And this is such a great bill, I volunteered to carry it myself, Mr. Chairman. This is truly a work of art. Mr. Chairman, what this bill does, it allows the option on your driver's license, if you go through all the normal routine of a driver's license, the application and the photo and all that, and if you wish, if you sign an application, which the Department of Transportation will prepare, it will put a symbol on your driver's license that there is a designated person who should be contacted in the event of an emergency. And that person will be on file with the Department of Transportation in their computer. The designation actually, and I'm going to show you a real-life driver's license belonging to Tina Sample, and it will be right up here on the corner of Tina's driver's license. If you look on your license, if you are a donor, it will appear right below that little heart thing on your license. Everybody, get out your license and look at it. Make sure it's yours and see if you got little hearts there. Below that will be the designation that you have someone to contact. Do you want to see Tina's? Well, you can't see the symbol on her because we haven't passed the law yet. But you can get a symbol on your license if you vote aye on this good little bill. It's really a good thing, and I urge favorable consideration. I will be happy to answer any questions that you have on this wonderful bill.
Thank you, Senator Schiffer. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, if the designee on the license is of the same sex, would that mean that this could be viewed as like a common law civil union or marriage in the state of Wyoming?
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, seriously, only the computer will know. But this is a good idea, folks, in all seriousness. If somebody needs to be contacted, they can get on that computer right away. This is a good safety feature. We have the technology to do it. It does not cost anything. If you don't want to participate, you don't have to. But I think it's a great idea, and I commend the sponsor for bringing it forward, and I commend YDOT for saying this is something we will do, and we'll do it at no charge because we believe in it. I also believe in it. I think it's a good idea.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 194, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. House Bill 194 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 204. Mr. Reeder, if you would read that.
House Bill 204, Patriotism in the Classroom, an act relating to public schools, sponsored by Representative Gay. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Coe, Cooper, and Jennings. No, Senator Rothfuss. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 204, Patriotism in the Classroom, do pass with no standing committee amendments, and I yield to Senator Jennings to explain the bill.
Thank you, Senator Jennings. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 204, Patriotism in Classrooms, very simple. It, one paragraph, it ensures the United States flag will be displayed in each classroom. It also states this flag to be standard size. That means the school districts have a size that go in classrooms. Also says there won't be another flag or any political stuff that's higher than the flag. And it says that the first period every morning you'll say the Pledge of Allegiance. And it says the district shall establish a policy which provides for students who do not wish to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. So they can either stay seated, they can step out of the room, whatever fits them best. We've had that, I mean, every morning we do the same thing. Everybody lives through it. I believe at one time there was a member that stepped out and nobody really made a big deal about it. So I think this is something that is probably a good thing. It makes provisions for somebody that doesn't want to participate. I'd ask for your aye vote.
Thank you. Discussion on the bill. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed there's no penalty provision in here. So what if you have a teacher who refuses to do it or puts a picture of Che Guevara or something above it just to make a point?
Senator Jennings.
Sends this all back to the trustees, so it'll be a condition of local control, and they can handle it however they want to.
Senator Nutting.
I just asked the sponsor to describe what a mandamus action is from line 4, page 1.
Senator Jennings.
I don't know. But I'm not sure I understand the question. Can we ask it again, please?
Senator Nutting.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just asking, it says that the enforcement is by a mandamus action. I'm just wondering what a mandamus action is.
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I think that that's the original bill, and we have a green copy. But just for the senator's question, a mandamus action is an equitable remedy in court in which you would come to the court, file a motion saying, by what authority do you have to do whatever it was? And it's generally issued at some sort of public entity.
Thank you, Senator Ross. Discussion, Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question. In a classroom in my district, a teacher who's very well thought of had several good things, I thought, on his wall, and the policy up there is to blank out all of that. I assume this bill would trump a district policy of enforcing clean walls. Just a question for the sponsor on that front, and this being one of those apple pie things, it'd be hard to vote against, wouldn't it?
Senator Jennings.
Yes, it would be hard to vote against. This bill says ensure that the United States flag is displayed in each classroom with the district. So they don't want and I would hope that it could be displayed. If you use the standard flag that the school district the education department has classified standard, I mean, it's stuck in the wall with the little bracket, so it's hanging out there just like the flags hang out there.
Other discussion? Senator Escobel.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if some teacher, for whatever reason, forgot to put the flag up or forgot to have the Pledge of Allegiance recited or, you know, something came up, how would that be viewed on her evaluation, her or his evaluation?
Senator Jennings.
Don't know, and I hope that we would never get into that. That would be a condition of local control. It would be kind of hard to forget. I mean, you kind of build the bracket, you stick it in there, and there would be no reason to take it out to forget to put it back up because it's inside, doesn't have to be retrieved at night. Most of this is done in most all the schools already. And it's done in most all states. There's just a handful of states that don't do this. Most schools do it over the loudspeaker. The intercom comes on, everybody says the Pledge of Allegiance, and they go about their business. So as far as somebody forgetting, they forgot. I don't see the Army coming in and making a big deal about it.
Further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 204, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 204 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 208. Mr. Reeder, if you could read that.
House Bill 208, Off-Road Vehicle Registration Exemption, an act relating to off-road vehicles, sponsored by Representative Shepperson. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highway, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Johnson, Landon, Nutting, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report. It do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 208, Off-Road Vehicle Registration Exemption. And to carry this bill on the floor, I yield to Senator Driscoll.
Senator Driscoll.
Move for consideration of this bill. House Bill 208 is a great bill. As all good bills should be, it's a one-liner, or actually a five-liner, but it's on one page. What this actually does is clarifies and expands just a little bit on off-road vehicles exempted for farm use. And basically, the legislature in past years, prior to the days of ATVs, had exempted all kinds of farm vehicle uses for ag use. What this does is adds a Section C to 312707 that says off-road recreational vehicles when being operated for agricultural use, including but not limited to irrigation, fencing, or moving livestock, are exempt from this article. And this is getting to be a pretty good-sized issue on the ranches. Years ago, we rode up and down our easements on our places, and we're allowed to just run. And this day and age, they're licensing all these off-road vehicles now, and it turns into another use tax that you use only on your own place. Generally, these are used either within the confines of a ranch. Example would be my place. Got a state highway running through the middle of it. It's on an easement. I actually own it, but they want me to license my vehicles. This cleans that up. I would stand for questions and encourage your passage of this.
Thank you, Senator Driscoll. Discussion on the bill. Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 208, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 208 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 209. Mr. Reeder.
House Bill 209, Emergency Medical Review Organizations, an act relating to public health and safety, sponsored by Representative Green. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 209, Emergency Medical Review Organizations. And for an explanation of the bill, I yield, I guess, to Senator Scott.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, for an explanation of the bill, what this is doing is putting the EMTs into this statute with the professional standard review organizations. Mr. Chairman, these are a time-honored device for trying to deal with medical errors and learning from them so they aren't repeated. The statute basically is used now typically by physicians. They'll have a review process. They'll all get together and discuss some of their hard cases and try to say, look, what could we have done differently? The principal one will present the case. The others will criticize, make suggestions. And you want a free-flowing, honest discussion so that everybody can learn from it. And the trouble is, in our litigious era, people are scared to do that because they're afraid that what they'll be hauled into court and say, what did you say at this? And so we have put an exemption in our statute for these organizations so that what they say is not discoverable, and it has proved to be, not only in this state, but all across these United States, a very useful technique for correcting and really letting professionals learn from experience. And the EMTs quite rightly want in the same statute so they can get together, often maybe with their medical supervisor, and say, okay, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? What can we learn from this? And it's, Mr. Chairman, it's a good bill that will improve the quality of work that our EMTs do in a very practical way. I would put in one caution. There is a Supreme Court case that suggests that the court might not obey the law if you had a case that was directly on point. And I have heard a very prominent attorney say that he really can't say what the law will be if you get a direct challenge. But so far that hasn't happened, and these things are operating, and people are comfortable with the protection they grant. Mr. Chairman, this is a practical thing you can do to improve the quality of the care that our EMTs give in some real emergencies. And I'd be happy to answer questions and urge its adoption.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 209, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 209 has passed a Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 224.
House Bill 224, Platted Plots Requirement, an act relating to property, sponsored by Representative Miller. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Lexington Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Case.
Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a do-pass recommendation on House Bill 224, platted plots requirement. Mr. Chairman, for an explanation of the bill, I would yield to anybody that would raise their hand right now, to be perfectly honest.
Senator Case, we're anxiously awaiting your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, this bill goes into 3412.115, and it says that no person shall sell as defined in WS 1853304, and that's where that's when you define what a sale is under the subdivision requirements. 185 is planning and zoning. Any lot in a town or addition to any town until the plat thereof has been duly acknowledged and recorded as provided in this act. And then there was this all fairly archaic language about fines, about you being fined $50 for each event that you don't do or whatever, and that's all being taken out. There's a new subsection B being added, and that's going to say the provisions of this section are enforceable by all appropriate legal remedies, including but not limited to injunctive relief or writ of mandamus. And Mr. Chairman, I think we had a perfect explanation of a writ of mandamus, and that's why we're here, and so be happy to answer any questions in detail.
Thank you, Senator Case. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, as I recall this bill, what we're doing is doing in the cities exactly what we did in the counties, which is with the definition of sale, which you see the reference there on page 1, line 13. We're giving them some flexibility so they've got some ability on a new subdivision to test the market and putting it exactly parallel to what goes on outside the cities So this is really just a technical cleanup on that. You do, recalling the discussion when we did the same thing in the counties, you do want them to have some ability to take and hold in, basically hold in a trust some earnest money so they can test the market. But you don't want a completed sale, because then that puts undue pressure in your planning and zoning people. And this is just making the law within the city the same as it is outside the city, and it's a good idea.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I can see from the list of Senate sponsors how important this bill really is. I appreciate it. But my question is, other than how important this is, what does this do to those? There's a group of larger towns that we have granted home rule to, and they pretty much run their own stuff inside of their town. I think like the town we're in right now. Are we starting to tell them what they can or cannot do? As I understand this, once they brought this chunk of ground into their town, they pretty much have free rein on what to do. Sounds to me like what we're doing here is saying, yeah, you've got home rule, but it's not quite as homey as it used to be. Could somebody explain that?
Senator Case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure there's that big of a change. It says that before, no person shall dispose of or offer for sale or lease any lots in any town or addition to any town or city until the plat has therefore been duly acknowledged. Now we're saying no person shall sell, as defined in the subdivision statute. But we've actually given them a little bit more flexibility, I would say. And if home rule were to come into play, they could talk about sale or lease, I would imagine. But this actually is a relaxation. And by the way, the writ of mandamus, that's a court order telling someone to do their duty, if I remember right, from college politics. I'm not sure this has a lot of play in home rule, unless, you know, cities always tell you they got home rule and everywhere. If you ask the municipality lobbyists, they'll say we could have done this by home rule or we could undo this by home rule. That's their standard pat answer, and not much of that goes to the courts to be tested. But if this is relaxing it, because no longer are we talking about offer, we're just talking about an actual sale. So I think it's more flexibility. If the city wanted to tighten that up, I suppose they could. And we might argue about whether they have that authority or not. But this is a relaxation.
Discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 224, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 224 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 256. Mr. Reeder.
House Bill 256, Wyoming Safe Homes Act 2, an act relating to domestic and sexual violence, sponsored by Representative Kraft. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 256, Wyoming Safe Homes Act 2. For an explanation of the bill, actually, Mr. Chairman, if you would, I'd ask that you go ahead and read in the Standing Committee Amendment at this time.
House Bill 256, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 5.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 256. I'll go ahead and explain what the amendment does, and then we'll turn it over to the sponsor of the bill to explain that. What you have with House Bill 256 is an effort to provide some victims' rights. The expressed intent of the bill as it came to the committee was to provide some protection and some actually interference with individual contracts, leases, in fact. And what you're talking about, the gist of the bill is that If someone's a victim of family violence or sexual violence, that their landlord couldn't evict them because they were a victim, because they didn't want the hassle of maybe the offender coming around and hassling them or making noise, things like that. They would protect against eviction. On the other side, would that be as if, in order for that victim to be safe, they needed to move, that they could actually get out of their lease basically interfere with the lease and allow them to be to get out of their lease initially. As the bill came to us, Mr. Chairman, if you go to page 6, and this has to do with the amendment, if you go to page 6 to the top through the first part of page 9, what we did in this is that as it came through, we looked at this and thought that what happened was a bill that was supposed to be about victims' rights and trying to help victims ended up being a bill about locks and whether or not the landlord should change locks and how that should work and who should pay for it and how it ought to happen. If it doesn't happen, they could run to court. And as we went through that, it just seemed to us it created a lot of issues for the bill as it would be administered and potentially impose liabilities that heretofore hadn't been recognized in Wyoming for landlords who might either be too slow to change a lock or be too fast to change a lock, or if they change the lock. And so it had to get into immunities for that. It created penalties for violations for landlords who didn't change locks fast enough or otherwise didn't meet the requirements in the Act about changing locks. And so what the bill does essentially is what the amendment does essentially is strike the provisions beginning on page 6, line 13, where you have, so basically you see there 121.1304, all of page 7, all of page 8, and then I believe we struck 121.1305, penalty for violation. And then down below, if you go to section 2, which starts at the bottom of page 9, there's provisions that, except as provided in Article 13, mostly also had to do with change of locks. So we struck those provisions too. We struck the issues with respect to section 2. So that's what that did. The Senate can vote that up or down. That was the judgment of your judiciary committees that came out here, that we would make it clean and do away and get rid of some of those problems. But if the body wants to address those problems, they certainly can. The other thing the standing committee amendment does is we just tried to go back, and I believe if you go to page 4, line 5, we tried to make a consistent use of some language there when we're talking about the type of evidence that has to be produced, that it would be, as you see there at line 15 through line 17 on page 1 of the amendment, that we're inserting as demonstrated by medical, court, or police evidence of domestic abuse or sexual violence. That language appears elsewhere in the bill, and so we thought that we would put it there as a clarifying. The other thing it did is it, if you go on page 4, line 7 of the bill, it removed there, and on page 5, line 4 of the bill, it changed the 30-day notice requirement, reduced it down to 7. And page 5, line 8, we just inserted the words domestic abuse or to try and make it clear that it was domestic abuse or sexual violence would apply in that case. That's what the Standing Committee Amendment does. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that you yield to the sponsor of the bill so we can discuss the amendment and his bill.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of the work that the committee did is, as one of the good senators called it, a little bit of streamlining on the bill. That's essentially what they did is the discussion was primarily around not having someone that's a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, evicted from their premises based solely on that concept. And then also, Mr. Chairman, a way to get out of a lease if they need to. Now, this whole thing, Violence Against Women's Act that was signed in 2005 by the then president afforded victims that opportunity that lived in public housing. Well, the fact that Wyoming doesn't have much housing and we've been experiencing these kind of issues throughout the state. I know that all 24 programs that support victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, said this is the number one reason that has caused homelessness. Now, so what we're just trying to say is that if you're a victim, you don't need to get evicted because of this. And there's some pretty tight regulations in there. It can't be just on hearsay. You can't just come up to someone, the landlord, and just say, well, I'm a victim, so I'm out. There's pretty tight provisions in here as far as requiring court documentation for that. So the amendment, as the good chairman from Judiciary said, is that, in essence, tightens up some of the more language. There were some concerns about some of the language on page 4, and then really just it takes the lock situation out. The association that sells houses and was there to just say, that, and my understanding is that a tenant, if they were in imminent danger, that they could change the locks and provide the landlord with a key. So not so sure that that was really the part of it. I really want to focus on the component of the bill. The main components of the bill is getting someone moved that needs to move when they're in a situation of imminent danger, and they prove, through these court documents that they are that they need to move. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take care of the amendment first. So, ask for your consideration on the amendment.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Tastert's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 256, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 256 has passed. Back on the bill. Question having been called on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 256, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 256 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 260. Mr. Reeder.
House Bill 260, Industrial Siding Financial Resources, an act relating to industrial siding, sponsored by Representative Stubson. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee whole rise report to do so with a recommendation that House Bill 260 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I'll refer the bill to Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what House Bill 260 does is it goes back and what I considered and the bill's prime sponsor considered were cleanups of some work that we did last year. If you go back to last year, we did a significant amount of regulation on wind energy. And in particular, we went in and wind energy facilities, wind energy farms that would have 30 or more towers were now came under. And what we did last year is we pulled those under the jurisdiction of the Industrial Siting Council. In doing that, we added some language and thought that maybe we had gone too far. And that's what this bill does for you. What this bill does is simply goes and in the work that we did last year, if you look at page 2, line 7, you'll see that we included in the language last year, and this language hadn't been there before, that the applicant has financial resources to now maintain, construct, maintain, operate, decommission, and reclaim the facility. And so that there are several places in there. And so what this bill does is go through with the Industrial Siting Council and the permitting process, and everywhere where the Industrial Siting Council would have the authority to review financial resources required to construct, maintain, or operate a facility, that it strikes that language to the Industrial Siting Council. Now, there's a number of organizations that are not entirely enthralled with the wind energy in our state who have come out and believe that this is an intrusion. But what I would bring to you, fellow senators, as you do that, is This does not apply solely to wind energy facilities. If you go to the Industrial Siting Council in this permitting process, it's a facility. And when you look at a facility under the Industrial Siting Council Act is an industrial facility, or facility means any industrial facility with an estimated construction cost of at least, and that number is now indexed to inflation, so it's now about south of $180 million. They fall under that. And in addition to that requirement, you also have some other facilities that now come under or meet within the definition of facilities. Those include any commercial waste incineration or disposal facility receiving greater than 500 short tons per day of household refuse. It includes some certain solid waste or hazardous material facilities. And then wind energy was defined. A wind energy facility having 30 or more towers is now defined as a facility. So when we talk about these facilities, it includes all facilities. So what you have before you, I believe, in House Bill 260 is a policy question, and that is, do you want the Industrial Siting Council to do an economic review of the feasibility and the financial capability or strength of any facility, not just a wind energy facility, but any facility who falls under the performance of the Act, to see if they have the financial resources to construct, maintain, and operate? We left in and thought it was, and certainly the intent last year was to make sure that the Industrial Siting Commission maintained and keeps the authority to make sure that an applicant has the financial resources and can pledge and provide adequate financial assurances that they can decommission and reclaim a facility. That hasn't changed. That remains in the bill. But the other side of that is, do we want our Industrial Siting Council to be the final say and the regulator about the financing of any project, whether it be wind energy or anything else that falls in the Industrial Siting Council? Those can be pipelines. Those can be power plants, coal-fired power plants, gas-fired power plants. Any of those things, if they come up and generate a high enough dollar value, fall under the Industrial Siting Council. So it's a matter of whether you want to have this matter of regulation imposed upon any of those facilities that fall under the Industrial Siting Council. The good representative, co-sponsor, and I, looking at this, thought that we didn't want that. We thought that the market and the finance companies and the investment bankers are the ones that ultimately would do that, and this didn't belong. And just as a parallel, if you wanted to be consistent about that, if you go to the Oil and Gas Commission, before someone drills for oil and gas, they have to provide a reclamation or bond for shut-ins and things like that. But there's no financial capability done by the Oil and Gas Commission about whether someone has the financial capability to drill and complete a well. So it's a policy decision whether you want this level of regulation in Wyoming or not, and that's my explanation of the bill. And with that, I ask your favorable consideration. Would stand for questions.
Thank you. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my colleague from Natrona County explained it very, very, very well. And typically before, we've never had any issues where there was any concern because it was not a matter of financial responsibility to construct, maintain, and operate. And these plants were very large. They were large plants. They were coal-fired power plants. They were large, compressor stations, those kinds of plants, over $180 million. My question is, and the concern I have, is you could have a situation where, and I hate to use the word, but a promoter might take a project a certain amount of the way and try to get everything approved and not have the financial responsibility to do anything, and yet have that, and I'm not thinking so much of wind, but I'm thinking of a particular project that was a power line we read about in the papers for 3 or 4 years, and I don't think that particular entity ever had any financial wherewithal. So the question I have, did you discuss or think about any way to protect ourselves from that, where somebody could go out and try to go through Industrial Siting Act, have no financial wherewithal, just to get a permit and get the process started, maybe even start the process to constructing it, having no finances, and then try to go out and find somebody to come in and buy their project?
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, I think this bill was well written to start with. The argument I was going to use was given to me by the great sponsor of the bill. We do require bonding for oil and gas, and there is no bonding in this. And should we have bonding? There is bonding. I stand corrected. I still think it's only common sense that you look to see that a project can follow its way through. And I have great concerns about having projects. I don't worry about the coal-fired power plants or the nuclear plants. But I do worry about the next level down of things, that they kind of get the thing started, and when it's all done, you got kind of a mess sitting out there, and it gets left back to us to figure out how to clean it up, or sometimes to a landowner. And I think there's some problems out here that this deal, actually leaving it there, doesn't put a huge burden on them. Anyone that's doing a $180 million project has a business plan. It's generally been seen around. And have that plan be looked at for industrial siting makes common sense to me.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the testimony in committee and in the bill, you notice that they struck the construction and maintenance and all that up front. But they left in the requirement to decommission and reclaim. So I wonder about a company coming in, and even my good chairman's question. If somebody comes in and they promote the deal and they have the financial proof that if they do start the construction that they can decommission and reclaim, why do we care about the rest of it? I mean, it's their nickel on the line, and it's their nickel to put it back the way it was. So what we should be concerned about is that if they decide to abandon the project, that they return the land to the way it was in reclaiming it. But if they try to market it, or they can't market it, all it does is gives them a bunch of free press and the ads they had to buy.
Senator Scott.
The question about somebody without the financial resources taking this all the way through the permitting and then having something, a permitted project that they could then market to somebody who actually wanted to construct it. The question I have on that one is, what harm does it do if somebody does that? It may make it quicker to get something built that we need, so that, because when they get it through that process, then you know what the requirements are going to be if they do proceed, and that might be a very useful service and enable a project to go forward quicker if somebody has taken the trouble to do that. Now, the risk would be if they got it half built and then it comes apart. But if you get it half built or do a lot of actual construction on it, then you've got some serious money came in somewhere to do take it that far. And I think you can depend on your lenders to or the venture capitalists, if they're not using a lender, to make sure that you've got enough money to follow through. So I can't see if even if this does allow some promoter to get a project shovel ready, if you will, and then proceed only if they can get the financing, what harm does that do? Why do we need, as the government, to come in and explore their finances in detail when we know that the private sector is going to take care of that?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just in response to the questions, I think the answer to the question about whether we talked about some of these things, the answer to that question is yes. What we've looked at that is and I get that a lot of people don't like wind energy. I get that. People are entitled to their opinions about wind energy, but in our efforts to saddle and create hurdles and obstacles for wind energy, keep in mind that what we're doing here and what this bill does the way it is right now, and what this bill does is help, is not just with wind. It affects, like we've talked about, any facility that's potentially, any industrial facility, which can include mines, coal mines, any uranium mines, anything that would go to $180 million, do you want the government imposing and making the decision about whether or not you have adequate financing? Now, it's also been represented to me by an individual who does practice and does work in this area that it costs about $500,000 to get a permit on that reclamation bond. So you've got about a neighborhood of $400,000 to $500,000, $600,000 posted in the form of a reclamation bond, even with this bill. So as we do that, and in fact, it finds me ironic to some degree, Mr. Chairman, that we would have a study that we commissioned for the nuclear energy industry and some of these other industries to look at regulation, say, what is the role of regulation, and is are the regulations too adverse and too difficult, and are we burdening commerce and industry in our state for certain industries? But then in the Industrial Siting Council, we come back and say, you know what, we want to have not only that regulation, but we want to have control about a decision with people who work in the government to decide whether or not there's adequate financing. When I think that as we've had that discussion, those things are I believe, resolved generally by the market, by the people who are financing, the people who start. I would also bring to your mind that I think one of the main purposes of the Industrial Siting Council and the Industrial Siting Act as a whole is mostly to protect landowners and local governments, to provide them notice and the opportunity to come in and participate in these hearings, Mr. Chairman, to see so they can understand what the impacts will be and understand everything from the impact on local government and schools and roads to cultural assets to game and fish to wildlife to whatever else. And so there's a large public process that happens through this. This is something that happens overnight or in the dark, but is in the full light of day with adequate opportunity for anyone who's interested to participate in these things. And ultimately, with respect to the bonds themselves, the concern is that someone would not be able to show any financial information at all. I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, and submit that when you come in and provide the information for reclamation bonds, either one, you're going to post a bond that's worth several hundreds of thousands of dollars, or you're going to have to provide financials to show that you have such strong financial capability of your corporation or entity in and of itself that it can self-insure in that regard. And so you're either going to have to post a significant cash bond, or you're going to have to show financial statements, which generally are going to be publicly information anyway, but it's going to be large companies that have large cash reserves, and those financial statements are going to have to be shown so that they can verify that they have the financial, they can provide the financial assurance on just a bare promise to pay from the company itself. So I believe that there's adequate protections in there, and the prime sponsor and I came down on the side that, you know, we're looking at what regulation is really necessary for Wyoming, and thought that we had gone too far last year and would ask us to back up to this degree. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of looking at this, and I've got a couple of things going on in my mind. One is that, boy, we just did all this last year, and it's almost still warm from the copy machine, you know. It's kind of interesting, and it seems to me that, I don't know, I don't tend to consider this to be just cleanup. I think it's just a little bit bigger than that, and I'm, I guess I've got some concerns. I kind of look at things, I'm a developer sometimes, and I'm nowhere near in this category, I assure you. I'll never face industrial siting for anything in my whole life, sometimes you go to work on something, and it just doesn't work out like you planned. And you may demonstrate that. You may start up front. I've had those bankers in across the table from me, and they love what I'm doing, and we're sitting there, and we got a plan, and then it begins to kind of fall apart. And I've had it fall apart on me, Mr. Chairman. And sometimes it starts to rattle up in the construction phase, and sometimes maybe in the operations phase, but things don't always go as planned. And I sort of see things as being connected. If you're a viable entity, I don't see how you can make a finding that A doesn't follow B, because you may start out and show that you've got decommissioning capability and financial wherewithal for that. You might even post a bond for that. But how much you need to actually post and what you have to clean up sort of depends on how well you do your construction. And sometimes you might leave in the middle of that and just leave the biggest mess you've ever seen, Mr. Chairman. That's a lot different than the mess you might have thought about if you were going to carry it through all the way and finish it out. So I sort of see construction and maintenance as being sort of connected to what the end mess is, which sort of means that they're all connected in terms of this financial wherewithal. And I don't see how you can say something about having decommissioned financial capability without talking about the rest of the strength of the company in other ways. And, you know, I know this isn't just about the whirligig things that are sit on top of the bluffs around Wyoming in increasing numbers, Mr. Chairman, but it does seem to me that there is an area where
financial wherewithal perhaps is fairly fragile, and more fragile, Mr. Chairman, than you might think. We had testimony through the Revenue Committee about some of the contracts and how thin the margins are and how really desperate they were for some tax relief. In fact, I think we spent a lot of time talking about tax relief for wind energy this year because of the desperate financial circumstance. So I'm thinking, desperate financial circumstance, decommissioning, all this happening. Maybe this is a bad time for a bill like this. And then I have to ask a question of the sponsor. Has anybody thought about any consequences? I mean, what happens when things start going bad with a developer? They get halfway in, they don't finish their project, maybe they go bankrupt. Do we revoke the permit? Is there any possibility of amending this on that line to talk about, that we're going to review the permit when the company gets into financial trouble? Anyway, Mr. Chairman, I guess this bill raised a lot of concerns for me, and I'm not won over yet.
Thank you, Senator. Other discussion? Senator Driscoll.
Second time. I think there's some great points there. I can't see. One, I'd like to ask a question of the sponsor. Is there people complaining about this part in there? Second, it appears to me, when you're reading through the deal and to render the decision for the Industrial Siting Council, it would be important to me if I was sitting on a council to be able to see kind of a business plan of how this thing's going to work. We're not just talking about going in here and digging some ground up. We're talking about having a project work. I would think if you were sitting on that council, you would like to see at least a reasonable shot of what this thing's going to do and how it's going to operate. We talked about cities and towns using this as part of their basis for impacts to them. It's really hard to see how business works when they put an ad in the paper and come up and said, I'll put a bond up. I'll start on it, and we'll do it. And, as we thought about it, I said, coal mines aren't there. And, I think I had one real close to the good senator from Campbell County. Can't name it by name, but that thing, I'm betting money could have come up with the money for the bond on that thing. Those guys would have come up with it. They were using state money to build it with, and they went right to the wire getting that thing done. And I represent to you that if that would have happened, that site would be abandoned now. They got to the point, and I believe they were either had a bond post, they were going to turn ground on it. That thing obviously was never going to work. Probably would have been a deal. We were back down here using the good senator in the back from appropriations saying, what are we going to do about this site? Because this was a coal mine, and it was going to have a lot of ground tore up. What are we going to do to clean it up? Are we going to use a little bit of the great money out of Campbell County to clean it up, or are we going to go use some AML money? I think as industrial siting, you owe it to yourselves to be able to look at a project intact. I urge you to vote it down.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the sponsors could explain to us, once you receive your industrial siting permit, ordinarily that triggers industrial siting payments. So now is there a triggering event, or how do we know that if we're going to make these, which incidentally, the industrial siting payments are no longer paid by the industry. They're a prepayment out of our sales tax. So the state pays the community the industrial siting payments out of sales taxes collected by the state, and they're deferentially paid to these communities. So I assume that if the wherewithal is not there to begin and complete the projects, a number of things can happen. But question one is, do the communities continue to receive the industrial siting payments even though the project doesn't go forward because it was never, and the applicant never had any intent to go forward. He just wanted to put together a package to go out and sell. Maybe there's a triggering device there. And the other question is what are the other consequences that are triggered by industrial siting that allow, ultimately, if you get condemnation authorities and things like this, and the project never goes forward, so the promoter, if you will, is out condemning right-of-ways, condemning through people's property, and he has no intention of ever completing it. Can those things happen under this bill as we have now set up?
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And moving it one step further, must be absolutely clear, the state of Wyoming is paying for the cultural and economic impacts to the local communities up front. Now, I think we, being the state of Wyoming, need to have some assurance that new power plant that they put up in the part of the state where I reside, when they come in, we get the impacts in our local community, whether it's man camps, whether it's roads, all that stuff. But we reimburse those local entities, cities and counties, from the state's coffers up front. What we want to know when we ask for construct, maintain, and operate, that they have the financial ability to do that, is there some protection for the state of Wyoming when we front that money that power generator up there really is bona fide? Because we'll get our money back sooner or later unless they go broke. Unless they just flop halfway through. That's why this is in here originally. That's the point of it. You know, reclamation bonds and all that stuff. That isn't the point of it. It's to make sure the state will be held whole. And we won't know that if we don't collect that they have the capability to construct, maintain, and operate. That's why those three words are in here. I'm a little concerned, and I'd like what other assurances do we have when the state has to pay those local entities up front out of the supposed sales tax that we're going to get and all the rest of that stuff that we probably will exempt anyway, but that's neither here nor there. That was another debate we had earlier. But that the state will be made whole because we are paying local entities for those impacts, whether it's roads, social services, police, fire, all those things that we should do, good things. But I want to make sure the state's going to be whole, and I don't know how to do it without having those three words in there.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll start with the last one first, the last couple ones first. What assurances do you have the state are going to be whole? What assurances do you ever have the state are going to be made whole? I don't care if the Industrial Siting Council has all the financial information in the world, it doesn't mean that bad things don't happen. This is not an insurance policy. There's not an insurance policy out there that can guarantee the state will get what they got coming to, whether or not those three words are in there or not. With respect to the Industrial Siting Council, that's a really nice thought. And in fact, for the most part, the Industrial Siting Council payments and the relief from the Industrial Siting Council have essentially approved illusory for most of our local governments. There's been a little bit in the good county where the Senate president has resides from, hails from. There's been some industrial siting impact assistance payments that have gone there, but for the most part, from the reports that I've had from local government is that those impact payments have yet to show up. They just don't qualify for the most part. There may have been some years ago, but in the last several years, there's not been much industrial impact money paid because of that. So, it'd be nice to know if the state could actually pay some money out to find out if they really should be whole. With respect to the financial, the implication is that there's no information whatsoever that's provided, and that's just not true. In order to assess the impacts, there's substantial information. You have to provide how many hauls are going to be on the roads. You come in and you provide how much information, what percentage of your payments and what percentage of your purchases and the equipment that you come in to build the industrial siting, the industrial facility, what they're going to be subject to tax, so that you can figure out what in advance what those tax benefits are. So it's not that they're playing button, who's got the button with financial information. The question isn't whether or not they get financial information. The question is, do you want the Industrial Siting Council to review that information and say, you know what, we don't think it's good enough. And if you start down that road, members of the 61st legislature, why shouldn't counties or cities be able to, when you go in with a construction permit to build a house, or you go in to do an addition to your house, why shouldn't they be asked? Why shouldn't they be able to see your financial information and make sure that you can fix that up and that you don't impact your neighbors because you're not able to have the financial wherewithal to complete your construction project? Why would we treat the industrial siting? Because it's bigger and maybe a bigger mess? Maybe so. But we don't do that for the oil and gas industry. And the other question was, and we don't do that for a lot of industries, but we're going to talk about doing it now because we're afraid of the whirligigs that go around and around and people don't like them. And we can do that. But I would submit to you that it's an inconsistent
when we're busy trying to look at how do you reduce regulation to the appropriate balance, and we do that, and then we're going to say, let's go and let's regulate in this regard. With respect to the, there are no insurance policies. There will be business plans, and there will be financial information that's out there, but there can be all kinds of bad things that happen, whether it's wind, whether it's oil and gas, whether it's uranium, whether it's coal, whether it's mega data centers, about things change. Those things, do things always work out as planned? You know, no. Life happens. Granted, life happens. It's a policy question. I don't believe that there's a lot of bump in the night that's any different or any different risk that we see one for another. But ultimately, it's a simple policy question is, do you want the ISC to be the super financial overseer on these projects and hold a permit on whether or not the judgment of the individuals at the ISC are that the financials are good enough so that the project can be completed? That's the policy choice, and let's vote it up or down, but that's the policy choice that this bill brings you. I don't think it has any particularly insidious intent, but it's just a policy choice. Do we want this level of regulation? And one other question was asked, who has complained about it? There have been some individuals have come forth and believe that that's inappropriate. They are not whirligig companies. There are other companies who are in other businesses that have pending applications before the Industrial Siting Council, and so they're from other industries. So, yes, there are some individuals who are looking at this now and are concerned that you have now the Industrial Siting Council with the ability to overrule what the best judgment of the company themselves, their financiers, their banks, their shareholders, their officers, and to overrule what they think is in, what they think is possible. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question having been called. Senator Case, one more.
It does come down to a policy choice. I think that's a good way to put it. And, you know, if these are superb, strong companies that have financial backing from their supporters and their investors, they have the ability to post bonds, they've demonstrated the capability to do this elsewhere, there's no problem. It should be a slam dunk for them to be able to demonstrate that they have that capability, and they should be able to fulfill this with the current language easily, that they have the financial resources to construct, maintain, operate, and decommission. If they've got to prove it for decommissioning, you've got to think all the way through to see how we get there. And so it's really not a big deal to leave the language as it is. And, yes, it's a policy choice. It's a policy choice. The whole thing about industrial siting is a way that we get a little handle, a bit of a handle, because we're kind of a small state facing some big investments and development sometimes gets focused on the smallest of towns. Like that poor little town of Laramie over there that's going to have that big data center come in and just overwhelm that town, Mr. Chairman. And I guess, oh, wait, we exempted that one. But we could find something else. But the basic point, Mr. Chairman, is our communities are small, relatively small compared to any place else in the country. The infrastructure is maintained on pretty thin markets here. Thank God for the mineral industry. But these are enormous local impacts, and that's why we have this law. And it's a policy decision that we've had, and the law works great. Let's not change it.
Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 260, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
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 House Bill 260 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
I know I make people nervous when I stand up, but Senate will take a 5-minute recess.
Let's just leave.
How about a stretch?
That'd be good. How are we doing? I'm figuring on the next one is probably going to go to the... We'll have to use the second page of the script.
The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 251. This, will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 251, Abortion Ultrasound Information and Act Relating to Public Health and Safety, sponsored by Representative Brechtel. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Geis, and Hicks. No, Senator Driscoll and Embrick. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that House Bill 251 do pass. And there's a standing committee amendment we just will read in, and I'll move it.
House Bill 251, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 251. I'll yield the floor to Senator Dockstetter to explain the bill.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bring you House Bill 251. Actually, there needs to be some clarification about what we have here. Abortion information, ultrasound. Abortion ultrasound information. The good Senator to the back of me here has distributed in your box a better description of what we're trying to do, because there's an amendment on it. And I'll have the good senator explain that amendment. But if you check your box, you'll find what the original bill, House Bill 251, should be saying. It's an act relating to provide health and safety, requiring physicians to provide patients with specified information before certain non-emergency abortion procedures and definitions, and amending a definition and providing for an effective date. The bill has been... The amendment takes the bill back to its original form, members of the Senate. If you go back, if you go down and track your amendment in, you'll see that it's cut back just to the basics. Under A, except in the case of a medical emergency, and I'm referring to your handout, at least 24 hours prior to an abortion being performed, a physician or a qualified person shall inform the pregnant woman she has a right to view the ultrasound of the unborn child and hear the heartbeat of the unborn child. And then finally, in B, this section shall not apply to an abortion performed. It's back to the basics, and I'll let the good senator from Goshen explain the amendment.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good senator from the western side of the state has pretty much read what the bill does. We'll go into, if you have this handout that has my name on it, that works in the standing commitment. Committee amendment into the House version, and you can follow along with that, Mr. Chairman. The good senator from the western side of the state has pretty much read the first part of it, and the next part of it really is this section shall not apply to an abortion performed, and these are in an emergency things, to save the life or preserve the health of an unborn child. And, Mr. Chairman, this may occur when the mother may have medical conditions which may require an emergency C-section or induced birth, and that may occur when you may have chemo or something like that, which may harm the child if it's carried to term. And so, in that case, Mr. Chairman, that section does not apply. It does also not apply to remove an ectopic pregnancy, And then if disclosures are required under A of this section, the physician or a qualified person, and there's definition later on in the bill as to what a qualified person is, a signed statement from the woman acknowledging that she has been provided that information in subsection A. And that statement would be placed in the medical file. It's treated as confidential medical document under all applicable state and federal regulations, so your HIPAA regulations apply. If you go over to the third page on that, medical emergency means a pregnant woman's condition, which on the basis of a physician's good faith clinical judgment complicates her health, that the immediate termination of her pregnancy is necessary to prevent her death, or creates a serious risk of causing her substantial irreversible impairment of major bodily functions. Qualified person, Mr. Chairman, is at Romanet 2, means a licensed psychologist, clinical worker, social worker, professional counselor, registered nurse, or physician. Unborn child means a human embryo or fetus. Mr. Chairman, there's been some concern that this bill gets in between the doctor and the patient. Mr. Chairman, what this bill, all it really does is one thing, and that is to say that except in the case of a medical emergency at least 24 hours prior to, you tell the pregnant woman she has the right to view an ultrasound. And, Mr. Chairman, that is pretty much all this does. If you look at the term unborn child, that basically has been determined in our famous case of what Roe versus Wade is that we can have no regulatory authority under any circumstances that would interfere with that Supreme Court case. This does not get into whether there's a choice or not a choice. This bill has nothing to do with choice, but except to the extent that it provides an informed choice if the woman wants to look at the information that's available to her. And I kind of look at my own situation, and you have to kind of take these things into account. And I think there's probably not a person on this floor that hasn't had a sister, a cousin, or a mother, or some relative, or a friend have this procedure. And, Mr. Chairman, I think that every one of us have also had different medical procedures ourselves. And I think of the medical procedures that I've had and what the physician has told me about that procedure. And, Mr. Chairman, I think in most cases, physicians will inform you about the side effects, the different things that may occur when you have those operations. And I think I've had an ankle operation. 2 or 3 weeks before I had that operation, the physician got with me, told me what all the different side effects might be. And I had a shoulder operation, the same thing. And I had a colostomy, and I, Mr. Chairman, the same thing. I think the only time when I didn't really have a full detailed report about what was going to happen in that operation, the side effects, is one time when I went to a doctor down here in Cheyenne, and I had a wart removed. And, Mr. Chairman, I didn't have to wait 24 hours on that. It was a simple procedure. But then again, the physician did tell me the side effects that might happen with that procedure. So, Mr. Chairman, what this bill simply does is go into that area of the area that's of an ultrasound. The other contentions that we've heard out here was that this was a religious bill. Mr. Chairman, this bill has absolutely nothing to do with religion. Mr. Chairman, I don't see one place in this bill that it says anything about religion, and I think that is just a red herring. In other cases, Mr. Chairman, let's see what else we have here. The cost of this, Mr. Chairman, there are pregnancy resource centers around the state that provide these services for absolutely free. So there's really no cost to the patient if they elect. And, Mr. Chairman, let me stress, this is totally optional. There is no dictation to the patient that you have to do any of this. The only thing that we say, the only request in this whole bill, is that the doctor allows this person an ultrasound if they so choose. And that's it, Mr. Chairman. It's a quick, little, simple bill. A lot of lightning rods have been shot at this thing, Mr. Chairman. But really, this is not a religious bill. It's only about an ultrasound, and that's the size of it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer, if I could, that handout that you gave the note that came on mine, said this replaces the last page. Is this a change to the amendment that's been submitted, or was this just for information?
Mr. Chairman, it's just for information.
Thank you. Discussion on the are we on the amendment? Would you like the amendment moved? It is moved. Question on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 251, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 251 has passed. We're back on the bill. Discussion on the bill. Question being called on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 251, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Division having been called. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please rise. The chair votes no. Pursuant to SR State Regulation 11-5, having failed standing division vote, a roll call is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Nope.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
No.
Amrick?
No.
Esquivel? Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon? Martin?
No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Andrew.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
No.
Von Platern?
No.
President Anderson?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 14 ayes, 15 noes, 1 excused.
House Bill 251, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to SR 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, if I could have the privilege of the chair.
You may.
This is speaking on behalf of the freshmen. I just wanted to express our thank you at the end of this part of the Committee of the Whole of the session for all the support from the senior members of the Senate, for the great support and encouragement from this staff. Thank you very much.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 90, do pass. House Bill 103, do pass, amended. House Bill 141, do pass. House Bill 147, do pass, amended. House Bill 161, do pass, amended. House Bill 178, do pass. House Bill 189, do pass. House Bill 194, do pass. House Bill 204, do pass. House Bill 208, do pass. House Bill 209, do pass. House Bill 224, do pass. House Bill 256, do pass, amended. House Bill 260, do pass. House Bill 251, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. President, move to approve the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those no. That motion is carried. That report has been adopted. Messages from the House.
February the 25th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 433, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill 100, Game and Fish Land Acquisition. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 1, 55 noes, excused 4. The House requests the Senate appoint a conference committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. February the 25th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 434, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 152, Very Rare or Uncommon Area Designations. Ayes 57, noes 0, excused 3. February the 25th, 2011, from the House of Representatives. Message number 435, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 100. The House conferees are Representative Shepperson, Chairman, Representative Blake N. Green, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
I do have a joint conference committee to assign here, and this is in regard to House Bill 100, Game and Fish Land Acquisition. That conference committee will be Burns, Christensen, and Jennings. Some enrolled acts. Senate Enrolled Act number 69.
Senate Enrolled Act number 69, being original Senate File 37.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 69, original Senate File 37. I've so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 70.
Senate Enrolled Act number 70, being original Senate File 47.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 70, original Senate File 47. I've so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 71.
Senate Enrolled Act number 71, being original Senate File 121.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 71, original Senate File 121.
so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 72.
Senate Enrolled Act 72, being original Senate File 143.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 72, original Senate File 143. So signed. House Enrolled Act number 59.
House Enrolled Act number 59, being original House Bill 254.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 59, original House Bill 254. And so signed. House Enrolled Act number 60.
House Enrolled Act number 60, being original House Bill 87.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 60, original House Bill 87. And so signed. House Enrolled Act number 61.
House Enrolled Act number 61, being original House Bill 138.
House Enrolled Act 61, original House Bill 138. So signed. House Enrolled Act 62.
House Enrolled Act number 62, being original House Bill 154.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 62, original House Bill 154. That's so signed. House Enrolled Act number 63.
House Enrolled Act number 63, being original House Bill 230.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 63, original House Bill number 230. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 64.
House Enrolled Act number 64, being original House Bill 243.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 64, original House Bill 243. I have so signed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, first of all, I'd like to thank all the committee chairmen for their help in helping me with General File. It's been a tough week. We've worked really, really hard. And as part of the process, I thank you all for your encouragement. And with that, I would say to you, have a good weekend. Monday, February 28th.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, two announcements. Your conference committee on House Bill 50 will meet at 8 a.m. Monday in the Senate Labor Committee room. So House Bill 50, I believe that's insurance exchange. The joint, and Mr. President, the Joint Interim Labor Committee meeting on topics for the interim failed this noontime because the House and Senate schedules didn't match. So we're going to try again. Senate Labor Committee will meet with our House counterparts at 9 a.m. Monday in the House Committee room, 9 a.m.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, there will be a conference committee report or meeting on Senate File 146 9 a.m. on S-13, which is appropriations upstairs. That's particularly for Senator Esquivel and Senator Jennings and myself. The Senate Appropriations Committee will be meeting with the House counterparts at 1 o'clock on Monday to go over interim topics.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. President, your committee number 9, or your conference committee for Senate file number 9, Economic Analysis, will be meeting Monday morning at 9 o'clock in room S-18.
Other announcements, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. President, Transportation Committee is going to try and meet with our House counterparts again on Monday at 8:30 a.m. in room H-11. That's over on the dark side. And we'll talk about interim topics.
Senator Jennings?
Mr. President, may I have the privilege of the floor?
You may.
Mr. President, I'd like everybody to come join the fun at the Friends of the Bow. If you haven't been there, you haven't had a good time.
Are there any other announcements? Go ahead, Senator Jennings, if you have.
Since the request was made where and when, it'd be Sunday, 5:30 at the Holiday.
Other announcements? The reading clerk would like to make an announcement, and I think with all the work he's done this session, he's probably entitled to the privilege.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is an invitation for those of you who are staying in town this weekend, and I assume most of you are. If you're tired of restaurant food, MSPA Chapter Number 36, which is a Masonic organization, is having a ham and bean feed tomorrow at 4 o'clock at the Masonic Temple. The Masonic Temple is down on Capitol and 18th. It's a donation. You'll have ham and bean, cornbread, coleslaw, and dessert. And if you so desire, if you've never been to the Masonic Temple, we can give you a tour of it. It's an old building, but it was very well made. It's got some very beautiful woodwork in it. And if you are waiting around for something to do Saturday, I would invite you down. Just walk in, and it's a donation type thing, and I think you'll be pleased. And thank you, Mr. President, and thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further announcements, I would say that we have not posted the road and travel report, but it seems to be pretty good. But if you have questions, the sheets, the printouts, and all are available back there on the back bench behind the bar. Motion was that the Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 o'clock, 10 a.m., Monday, February the 28th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. We stand adjourned.